Hey, this is Brandon Cook from Black and Blue, and you're listening to Power Rock Podcast with host Jim Madonna. Crank it up!
Hey everyone, Jim Madonna here, your host of Power Rock Podcast. I'd like to welcome you all to yet another episode, bringing you the best interviews from around the globe, from indie to mainstream, whether it be rock, metal, heavy metal, speed metal, contemporary, melodic rock, we got it all. And friends, I'm here to tell you that today's show is going to rock, because I have on the line guitarist, teacher, and songwriter, Mr. Brandon Cook of Black and Blue. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing outstanding, my friend. Brandon, I truly want to thank you, man, for giving me a call. For me, this is truly an honor to have you on my show. You know, I'm just a little fish in a big pond. I can't wait to get into this interview, to talk with you, to get some history, crank out some Black and Blue. We're going to play some other material from some other projects that you're on. Again, I just want to say, man, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoy doing interviews and meeting and talking to new people all the time, so this is fun for me.
First of all, you're not only a guitarist, but you're a teacher and a songwriter. Why don't you talk a little bit about the songwriting here, and then we're going to get into the Black and Blue.
Songwriting has been something I've done since I was a really young kid. I can't really remember a time when I wasn't singing some little ditty that just hooked out of my head, you know? And, you know, by the time I left high school, I had written almost two albums worth of material. Some of it never got recorded. Some of it did. But my first three-song demo was done when I was 17. And then I went to music school, and the hard rock songwriting stuff didn't really happen much there. But when, as soon as I got out of college, I just had this glut of material. I was about 25 when I finished college, because in the middle of college I had some hand problems. I had carpal tunnel, and it took me a couple extra years to finish my music degree. But when I got out, I had been doing a lot of singing and playing guitar, and I've always sang and played my guitar. When a couple of songs I wrote for this band, they weren't accepted because the band didn't write them. I was like, oh, okay. And the lead singer said, well, why don't you go do your own project and we'll write songs together. And I'm like, okay. So I went and did my own project. Stuff turned out really good, and I started developing my voice. So I've been singing lead and writing my own material for about 15 years. I just love doing it. It's led to doing a lot of different projects over the last few years. One's called State of Balance, and the other's called The Low Order. Not only singing and playing your instrument helps you get gigs, you know, helps you, like, get into a lot of projects, because you can do backup, you know, if there's, like, an errant song that needs, you know, the guitar player to sing lead on. But the songwriting stuff, I wrote songs for commercial work. Like, one of the songs that I wrote with The Low Order is now a theme song for a show called The Heavy Hitters Outdoors. It's a show that's up here in the Northwest on Comcast Sportsnet Northwest. It's a subsidiary of NBC, and we've been sort of selling that show for a while. It just came on the television last fall, and it was one of my best successes. You know, I got one of my songs that I helped co-write with my lead singer Jeff Buhner got on TV, and we just freaked out. We saw it. We're like, yes, song on TV.
And now we're referring to the band The Loyal Order.
That's right.
Right. And the name of that song was
Off the Grid Superhuman. It's a really heavy, like, sort of, it just kind of has this southern thing to it. I grew up in the country and, you know, grew up around rural areas. When the guy said what he wanted, I just basically came up with a riff right there on the spot. And then the song developed over about a month. My lead singer called me one day and he said, okay, project to go. I'm going to come over and we're going to finish this song. And by the time he got there, I mean, it was literally like 20 minutes. I had all the riffs written, and he and I just sat and arranged the stuff together. And one of the things that happened, he's like, hey, we need a bridge for this. And I was like, you mean like this? Fell out. And it was one of those songs that just came together so perfectly. You know, all the riffs and melodic ideas just happened. And it was no fighting. It was just getting out of the way of the creative process and letting your mind do its work.
I'll tell you what, Brandon, why don't we go ahead and let the listeners hear Off the Grid Superhuman with The Loyal Order on Power Rock Podcast. Crank it up.
Mm-hmm.
welcome back. We are with Brandon Cook. Brandon, dude, that song is a absolute smoking tune. I definitely agree with you. Well, the riff's killer, man. Great job, my friend. Great job.
Thanks, man. The songwriting thing for me is like composition in general. I mean, like I said, I've been doing it for, I mean, as long as I can remember. As soon as I picked up my guitar, it wasn't about like learning other people's stuff. Though I did do that, it was more about just like getting my ideas out and, you know, writing and playing and working with other people. And this is like one of the, it's like a culmination of like, you know, the stuff I'm doing now, it's a culmination of all the stuff I've worked on in the past. In college, we had to do like these really intense compositions, you know, that we had. It was like our composition teacher was like amazing composer, and he just pushed us so far. When I got out of school, it was, composing was just easy. It just, it was already something I liked to do, and I just didn't have to work as hard at it because he really helped us tap into how to be creative and how to tap into our creative selves. And it really, doing that stuff, I wouldn't say it's easy, but I love to do it, and I get to do it far more often than I thought I'd ever get to do it.
So basically you're doing what comes absolutely natural, and you're just enjoying, like you had stated, what you do. Well, you got the both the best worlds here, right? You know, I mean, that's great, man. I had originally stated that we were going to start out with Black and Blue. Tell the listeners, how did you end up being a guitarist for them?
Well, let's see. What I remember is I was driving to a rehearsal with a band that I was in at the time called Live Undead, and it was a Slayer tribute band.
Okay.
And I was rehearsing for like two or three different shows at that time. I had some Guns N' Roses tribute stuff going, my Slayer tribute band going, and that weekend I had an Iron Maiden tribute gig that I was doing. So I still had like five songs to learn for that weekend. And Patrick Young, the basser for Black and Blue, called me. I walk into this grocery store and I get a phone call, and I'm like, yeah, who is this? And he's like, hey, it's Patrick Young. And I'm like, oh, hey, what's going on? You know, nice to hear from you. And he started telling me about Black and Blue's guitar position and that Whoop was retiring essentially from music, and they needed somebody to fill in the spot, and they had a couple shows coming up really fast, one of which was the Rock and Skull gig that I met you at, Jim. And it was the last week of August, and Rock and Skull was middle of October. I had a bunch of stuff going on, and they wanted me to get up to speed really fast. I made a deal with them. I was like, look, if you want me to audition, just come out to the show this weekend. I've been learning all these Iron Maiden songs. If you think I can handle, you know, what you're doing, you'll definitely know, because I'm pretty under the gun for this gig. And he was like, okay, that sounds like a deal. We talked more about like what the gig would entail. And he just said, look, this is really, really hard music. You know, we've had other guys try this stuff. It's detailed. There's more to learning Black and Blue songs than just a riff. And I was like, okay, that sounds about like the way I think anyway. So let's plan it like this. And we made a deal that he was going to come to the gig that weekend. And if they liked what they saw, I'd learn five songs in a short amount of time, move forward with joining Black and Blue. So they liked the show. They thought it was really good. And they called me on Monday and said, okay, learn these five songs by Wednesday. So I learned five songs in two or three days. I can't remember which it was. I think it was Wednesday or Thursday after the phone call. They were really impressed. So I got hired on the spot. You know, they were just, wow. I think they needed to call Jamie or something, but Sean and Patrick were really impressed with my preparation skills. And I came in loaded for bear. You know, I wouldn't take a gig like that half-cocked. I really practiced hard and learned as much as I could without, you know, because Sean still had to say, hey, that's not your part. You have to learn this part, and, you know, this solo is going to be mine, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we worked out things like that together. So in about 6 weeks, actually 5 weeks, I had learned all a 90-minute set for Black and Blue. It was one of the hardest musical experiences of my life because the detail level with this music is profound. I mean, like, so many little details in the songs. Like, if you don't pick it this way, it's going to sound funny. And I'm, you know, they were thinking like I was going to be all like resistant to that. And I'm just like, no, man, I hear you. When I pick it that way, it doesn't sound right. You're correct. So if it's an upstroke or a downstroke or a slide or a bend, you know, you have to make sure that you get all that stuff right. And being a teacher for 20 years sure helped with like learning how to play Black and Blue songs.
Right.
Because, you know, you want to always do it right and do it authentically. Authentic thing, you know, I'm the way I always think of things when I'm learning other people's material is I want it to sound authentically like their band. You know, I don't want it to sound kind of halfway like their band. Like when I learned, you know, a Tommy Thayer guitar solo or Jeff Loop Warner guitar solo, you know, I try to get the essence of the way they play. Not only that, but the notes as accurate as I can.
Right.
Every once in a while, I'll take liberties, but it's always with permission.
Well, you know,
like, yeah, that one's okay.
Well, being a guitarist and a vocalist, you know, let me reiterate that. Being a guitarist and a vocalist, you know, you have worked with many artists throughout your career, and you know, you've worked with a lot of mainstream artists. How was it for you to actually, you know, internalize that you were part of Black and Blue, and what was your emotion? You know, what
the emotion for me was ecstasy. You know, it was pleasure. It was like, I wasn't really afraid. There was moments where I got a little nervous, but it was more like excitement. You know, I felt excited. I wanted that, you know, the hard work that I had done all the way up until that point. You know, I know, like, knowing what I know now about those guys, I never have worked with anybody that's so detailed about music. You know, a lot of people before that are kind of like, you know, kind of halfway about things. And, you know, even the best musicians that I've worked with still didn't take it, you know, like to the extreme that the guys in Black and Blue did, you know. And it really, it set the tone for the first show. You know, I hadn't met Jamie or Pete until I got into the car with them. Drive from the airport in Denver.
Nothing like pressure, right?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, like, I've done a lot of things to, like, learn how to handle pressure like that, but nothing beats, like, the hundreds of gigs I've done with my Guns N' Roses tribute band. You know, we've done so many really hard gigs, you know, driving from out of town and, like, playing really, really hard material that's not our own and trying to live up to the standards so that when people hear us, they go, oh my God, you sound better than Slash. And I'm like, well, that's not true, but thank you. But, you know, you have to do a certain level of, like, you know, for me to learn like a Tommy Thayer solo or, you know, to have to play their material that's, you know, worldwide, you know, it's been heard by literally millions of people, you know, the first, or well, at least hundreds of thousands of people. You can't suck. So, you know, with Guns N' Roses, millions of people have heard this stuff, and they know what this stuff sounds like. So there's a lot of pressure to sound the best you can.
Well,
so when I stepped into Black and Blue, it's just the mentality was there, and the mentality was right, and they got that I had the passion to learn what they were doing. And Jamie was really cool with me right away. He took a liking to me, and, you know, I respect the guy immensely, so...
That's awesome. You know, you had mentioned, you know, the Skull Fest out in North Platte, Nebraska. I happened to be at that show. I have to say this, Brandon, that it was my first Black and Blue show. It was, for me personally, it was jaw-dropping. I mean, just to watch the energy, watch the connection that was made on that stage. I could smell and taste the chemistry that you guys had. And I stood in front of you and watched you play that guitar. You mentioned you're no Slash. Well, you know what? Slash is no Brandon Cook. How's that sound? Because, bro, let me tell you something.
Thanks, man.
Bro, listen,
I appreciate the compliment.
I'm not saying that because, you know, we're doing an interview. I'm saying it because it's the truth. You have an amazing gift. It's crystal clear. That's why I'm going to repeat myself and say that's why I am so honored to have this opportunity to interview you, because talking with such humble people like yourself, man, it's just, you stated earlier, you don't get nervous. Well, you know, it's funny, but I'm nervous interviewing you, you know?
If you knew me in person, you would never get nervous.
Well, I see what you write on Facebook and stuff like that, so I know you're pretty humble, and you know, you keep things very mellow. So it's all good, man. But you know what? I had picked some Black and Blue tunes out. One of the songs that I had chosen, "I Want It All, I Want It Now."
Awesome.
Now we're gonna end up, we play three Black and Blue tunes, but we're gonna start with that one, and this happens to be one of my favorite Black and Blue tunes. So here it is, "I Want It All, I Want It Now," with Black and Blue and Brandon Cook on Power Rock Podcast.
My mind for you.
Welcome back. Again, we are with Brandon Cook of Black and Blue.
You know, we haven't done that song live yet, but our other guitarist, Sean Sunshine, loves that song, and he wants to do it really bad. So that may come up sooner than later, but I can't make any promises. I don't make the set list, but those guys, you know, I know Sean really wants to play it, and he's been asking to play that again for a while, so that might come up.
Since you've only been playing with Black and Blue for just a couple years, when you guys are backstage and, you know, because you're so new to the band itself, however the chemistry is tight, you know, what goes through your head, you know, before you hit the stage? What is there anything that you do, like prep work, anything like that, you know, to psych yourself up for a gig? Or do you just strap your guitar on and just...
Well, that's a really good question. It's just something I had to work on a lot, you know, coming up, because I used to get really, really nervous. Like, when I was a kid, I remember being 8 years old and, like, having to do a speech on stage and running off the stage crying, that kind of thing. I used to get really bad stage fright. But what I figured out was I had to learn how to, like, not think about what was coming and just stay in the moment. So, like, there's, you know, sort of a meditative type thing for me where I'll feel my feet on the ground and, like, feel my legs and my pants. You know, it seems kind of like new agey crap, but that's what I had to do. And now I'm like, when I go on stage or when I'm prepping for stage, I have to actually have to, like, you know, get my body physically hotter. So I'll do stretching and, you know, I'll do like lunges and kind of jog in place a little bit. And I have to get my, you know, because I don't get nervous anymore, really, I actually have to physically pump myself up, get myself short of breath, get my body temperature up.
Well, let me say this, you know, watching you perform in Nebraska, man, you know, you're high octane, man. I mean, you know, when you hit that stage, the hair's flying. I mean, and it's, like I said, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. I guess I can understand the lunges and the stretches and all that, because I think if I was to do that, we'd have to call an ambulance. I'd hurt myself, man. Well, I really would. I'm too old for that.
This past summer, I had kind of, like, you know, because I was starting to get noticed more, like, when I was backstage or, like, out in the crowd and stuff, and I start to get talking a lot, you know, and I love talking to people, so it's hard for me. I can't resist, you know. I love chatting with people and walking around the grounds of the watching the shows and, you know, staying up late and talking to folks, and, you know, my body took its toll, so I've been, like, because of all that high-octane energy and just banging it out every night, you know, every night that we play anyway, you know, it took its toll. So I've been doing a lot of recuperation, but, it's good stuff. You know, that I've always wanted to play that way on stage and figured out a few things about how I want to perform over the last 10 years or so. I played this gig with those couple of gigs with Chris Caffrey from Sabotage. He had his own solo band, and, you know, there was some criticism of my stage presence, and, you know, I watch the videos and my hair is flying and I'm headbanging and stuff like that. And I'm just like, okay, what is it that I'm not doing that is getting me, you know, criticized for my stage presence? I have to figure it out. And I never figured it out, but all I know is I don't hear that anymore. People say that I have really good stage presence and, you know, they love the way I perform.
Absolutely. And I would agree. I agree.
And it's following my own heart, you know. It's not necessarily listening to anybody else, but, you know, watching amazing artists that I love to see perform, and watching, you know, other types of performers, like not just musicians, like ballet dancers.
Right.
And I have a friend who's a belly dancer, and I'll watch how she moves, watch exotic dancers and how they move. And it's like, there's this really interesting there's a way that people captivate you when they're performing. And you can't do that no matter what you're doing. Your hair could be flying, you could be doing all kinds of intense stuff, but if it's not captivating for the viewer, you know, or it turns them off, or you're doing something that's not in your character and not in your body type, it doesn't have that attractive or seductive feeling, you know, it kind of turns people away. So you have to find, like, whatever it is that really is in you, and how you look best on stage, and like.
But wouldn't you agree, even though that yes, stage appearance is important, there may be a list of things that people look for in an artist on mm-hmm. stage. However, wouldn't mm-hmm. you agree that one of the most important things on stage is simply to be yourself? There's no point of trying to be somebody else. There's only one Brandon Cook. Why change him? Either love me or move on.
Yeah, that's funny. You know, like when I took on like tribute roles, like Flash, or like, you know, like playing Yannick Gers or whatever, whoever I was like doing a tribute to, there were always people that I wanted to perform like anyway. You know, there were always people that I either wanted to play guitar like, or I wanted to saw something in them that I was like, wow, that's really cool the way they do that.
That was your influences.
The way they look on stage is really... Yeah. So like I have some of my friends, we always say that going to a show is 50% visual and 50%, you know, sound. Because, you know, if you play album perfect on stage and you just stand there, nobody cares. You know, they can stay at home and listen to a CD and get that. So when you go on stage, you know, you have to move with the music and create something visual that they want to see again, you know. And I mean, I've literally spent the last 10 years developing that, you know, and trying to make sure that, you know, the music is expressed through visual, you know. I mean, it might seem like nobody really talks about that. They always, you know, they're kind of too concerned with being cool and like, yeah, that's how I am. I'm always like that. And it's not. It's like, for me, when I'm off stage, you know, I put away the trunks. You know, I'm not moving like a professional wrestler when I walk down the street. You know, I have confidence, and I'm like, you know, but I'm a normal guy. You know, I'm a dad, and I want my daughter to know that when daddy comes off stage, you know, he's daddy, not, you know, the giant persona that I let escape when it's on the stage.
Right.
Stage is where I'm the most comfortable, you know, but when I'm home with my kid, I want her to know that I'm comfortable there.
Right.
And not that same dude. I'm not I'm not really comfortable with the term rock star anyway, but I'm definitely not that when I'm home with my kid, you know. And
sure.
I like when I am on stage, I really let the beast out, you know, like that beast that other people aren't comfortable with you being in their normal everyday life.
Right.
That's my place to play, you know, and really be 100% me.
Okay. What, yeah, you know,
for better or worse.
Right on. And, you know, in your opinion, you know, being an artist and being, you know, in the business for so long, as a whole, we could both agree that the music industry has really took a turn. Things have changed majorly with social media, digital downloads, so on and so forth. In your opinion, do you ever see the true music business coming back?
I do not, like the way it was. I mean, the way the music industry evolved anyway was like what we had in the 80s was an evolution from where it was in the 70s and the 60s. Like in the 60s, everything was based off singles anyway. Like 45s were how people moved records. The concept of an album, you know, was usually like a compilation of all the singles that artist had done before. So nobody even did a record. Like doing a record as a normal habit was something that came around like the Beatles time. You know, most of the time what people were doing was record single, 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 release your singles, release your singles, release your singles, and then release an album of all those singles, and then make, you know, kind of like a greatest hits thing. Just because nobody wrote prolifically enough as a band to have, you know, an album worth of material. You know, there was always songwriters and stuff like that that, you know, the producer would go to Tin Pan Alley and pick out a bunch of songs and then make their artists record those. So then they put out that single. And if you actually had enough hit singles under your artist name, you could do that. But most artists couldn't do that. And now it's like it's such a habit that the bands write all their songs and then produce an album. In the 90s, in the early 2000s, when most artists put out a record full of, you know, awesome material, that our fans started getting pissed. I mean, I remember just talking to people on the internet when the internet was first starting to be like a social phenomenon. People were angry. They just bought the new Megadeth album, and it has three good songs on it. You know, I love Megadeth, and that particular album they were talking about, I loved all the songs. But, like, tons of fans were saying that. Like, Metallica records, when the Load records came out, they were like, they didn't want to buy the whole record because they only had, like, three or four good songs. You know, and then pop records were the same way, you know. And I didn't buy records unless I really, really loved the artist. And people were starting to do the Napster thing and download records for free. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? Right. And you could see where it was going, you know, even back then, you know, because bands were not putting out material that was high enough quality. You know, it was just really, the music industry was hurting on a creative level. And mostly it was because the best artists weren't getting out there, you know, and the internet sort of provided an avenue for like competition, you know, in the 80s and 90s, really amazing bands were getting shelved. Like they were getting purchased by the record labels, paid millions of dollars, you know, that they put into an album. And then when the album was done, they put it on a shelf, not do anything with it. Now those same bands can put out their own record that's like nearly the same quality as any of those things and put it out on the internet and become their own sensation. The market literally dictates. It's more like free market capitalism than any other business in the world. You know, like if somebody has a hit on YouTube, the record company is there right away to swoop in. Capitol Records just heard your new single.
So, I mean,
and we want to put it out.
Right. So pretty much, I mean, am I understanding you correctly by saying that in today's music business, a record label is really not necessary because it can be done self-produced, or?
I'm saying that record labels are very useful because they have the money and the infrastructure. That, I mean, they've purchased all the infrastructure. They have everything at their disposal. So you can't access that infrastructure without going through them anyway. They have a monopoly, and an extremely unfair monopoly. There's only three or four record labels. Pretty much every other major record label, like major independents, they're all owned by Warner Brothers, Atlantic, Island Geffen, and, you know, Time Warner. You know, there's no real record industry anymore. It's a bunch of offices with guys, you know, that own a bunch of infrastructure.
Right.
You know, and the producers, the few producers that really know how to make a hit single, could take one of those bands that, you know, puts out a really amazing song on the internet and go, hey, Capitol Records heard that. They want me to produce your album or whatever. You know, I don't know the conversation, but you get your record deal, you put your song out, and then you can, that's more, it's very similar to the way we used to do shows. You know, it's easier to get, it's just easier to get material recorded at a high quality. So it's easier for a record label to know what you can do in the studio, you know, and how good you can write. It's just easier. They go, hey, what, you know, how can we hear you? And you go, here's my YouTube channel. And they go, wow, you have some great songs. Instead of before, it's like they had to wait a week to get your package. And then they had to go through a stack of papers and then call you back. And then you had to record more songs, and that could take a month. But now, I mean, like most artists are always writing, and it's easier to get a high quality product. Because I mean, like, I could do a high quality demo here in a day if I wrote a song yesterday. You know, create a drum track, play bass, play guitar, have my singer come in, lay down a cool vocal track. I could do it here at my house and have a demo ready for a brand new song for somebody in, you know, under 24 hours. It wouldn't be like record label produced quality, but it's good enough to get somebody to know, hey, is this song good enough? Does that make sense?
It makes total sense.
Whereas 15 years ago, the process of getting a demo done was call a studio, you know, create a relationship with a producer, all this stuff that you have to do to get your song recorded. And by that time, somebody else is ready, and you may not get listened to.
Right.
But the opportunity is immense in the record label, or sorry, in the music world. The way people can do things, the opportunity is just immense. And so for some people, that's overwhelming. For me, it's how I think. Not many people agree with me, I would say, because I carve my own path when it comes to creation. And I've been doing, you know, creative work since I was, I mean, I remember the very first song I wrote, I was skipping down my babysitter's driveway when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, I've literally been creating music as long as I can remember. And so, like, I know there's other people out there that are like me. The artistry is there.
All right. So I'll tell you what, Brandon, let's go back to Black and Blue. And there's another tune that I want to play, and it's ever so popular, man. The name of this one is called Hold On to 18. Now, this song, I mean, I know you've been with the band just a few years, but what is the, like, the statistics? Like, is that, like, the number one, if you could place a number one on that? Or, you know, where would, because when I thought of Black and Blue back when I was growing up, it was Hold On to 18. So where does that, this particular song, where does that stand in the resurrection or the birth of, what did it do for Black and Blue, man? I mean, is that what put them on the charts?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this was the first song that really like got people's attention, and it's our closer, you know, I mean, unless we do an encore, which we usually do, but when we play Hold On to 18, it's like, that's the one. Everybody sings every word. Whether it was that way from the beginning, I don't know, because I wasn't there. But now, I mean, that's the one that everybody sings. And when I say, hey, yeah, I'm Black and Blue, and I just joined Black and Blue a couple of years ago, and they're like, oh, my God, Hold On to 18, right. And I'm like, yep, that's the one. I get to see, you know, on the cable music channels, Hold On to 18, Miss Mystery, Live It Up. I mean, people constantly send me things from, you know, Sirius Radio. Luke Carl really likes to play us on Sirius XM Hair Nation. I'm just like, yeah, thank you so much, Luke Carl. That's badass.
That's awesome, man. Let's let the listeners hear Hold On to 18 with Black and Blue on Power Rock Podcast. Crank it up.
Thank you.
are back with Brandon Cook. When I was introduced to Black and Blue again, like I said, you know, that was it. Hold on to 18, man. Great 80s. Great.
Yeah, I think somebody told me that that wasn't our first single, but remember exactly what our first single was. But that's the one, man. That's the one that really got the people really latched onto. Forward to playing it every show.
Cool, man. Let's go ahead. Let's jump over to your other project, The Loyal Order. You've got you've been writing some material, and from what I understand, there's a new song out. Or can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're in the midst of writing our album right now. And the way we've been doing things is we'll make a song, and then we'll make a video, and then release them simultaneously so that people can, you know, see what our vision is for this band and kind of get more of what we're about, you know. We haven't done a show yet, but we have three songs and three videos for a video for each one of the songs. And we just finished recording a brand new song called The River.
The River?
I really want to play it as for you. Yeah, this is going to be like, this is going to be the world premiere for The River. You'll be the first person that gets to play this on your show.
No way. That is awesome, dude. Thanks so much, man.
Hey, no problem. It's work that probably, like, song that I'm most proud of in all the stuff that I've written. And when me and my singer heard the end product, after we finished recording it and mixing it and mastering it, we were just, oh my God. The feedback that we've gotten from some of our friends has just been ridiculous. I can't wait for you to hear it.
All right, well, here it is. The River with The Loyal Order with Brandon Cook on Power Rock Podcast.
Said this thing that we are a moment at the train, our heads across the water, and the river knows my way back home. Surrender. The shot rang out for days, and the river knows my way back home. the shot ring out for miles. And the river knows my way.
Man, we are back, dude. Kicking tune, man. I well arranged. And thank you so much, man. Great, great stuff, brother.
You know, that song, like, because of the nature of the tune, it was kind of a epic song. We worked that song so hard, like the melodies and the riffs and everything, they were so good. We were like looking at each other across the writing table, so to speak, going, we have to make this perfect, because everything, we were just so inspired to work on it. When we got it in there with our producer, all he had to do was move a couple things around, and you know, he was just more encouraging than anything. He's just like, oh man, this is going to be so good. And I don't really worry about like what other people think of my music too much, but you know, I just know we worked really hard on this song to make it the best it could possibly be. And I'm really glad you liked it, man. Thanks for playing that for us.
It's my pleasure, man. It's definitely a hot tune, man. So what we're gonna do, Brandon, is we are gonna play one more Black and Blue tune. I'm gonna ask you a question after that. Then we're gonna go ahead and close it out, man. And
okay,
the next track I want to play is off the album Without Love, and it's called Strange Things.
Love that song.
Is this a song here that you guys play live, or because
you know, I don't know that they've played it live. I think Jamie said they played it once or something, but I love that song. When I listened to the first time, I listened to Without Love all the way through, because some of the Black and Blue material I wasn't familiar with at all when I joined the band. And you know, I just knew that they were local Portland guys, and I had seen him live a couple times, and I was actually Tommy Thayer's guitar tech when they got inducted in the Oregon Music Hall of Fame.
Wow.
But they didn't know me at all. You know, I played in a band with Tommy's brother. Anyway, I didn't know him very well. And so when I listened to Without Love, that song stuck out to me, just a great tune. And I'd come to find out, I think it's one of Jamie's favorites too. And he just talked about it online a little bit ago, but I'm really happy you're going to play that one, because that's one of my faves.
If you had to pick out of the songs that we played on this show, what would be your favorite?
Of all the tunes that you played?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Black and Blue songs?
I'll tell you what. Let me ask you the question later. Here it is. Strange Things, Black and Blue, Brandon Cook on Power Rock Podcast. Bring it up.
Are gone, things are just too empty, yeah. The rats are gnawing at my brains again. And if I see that face inside the mirror, I'll fight it desperately. Things you'll never know. Strange things coming through my body.
surprise. Think I leave this dream behind. The rats are dancing in the brains again. One final shot relieves me of this nightmare. The face of death I see. Things you never know.
Welcome back again, man. Brandon, you know, that's a great album all the way around.
I love Without Love. That's completely. Some really awesome stuff on it.
But I want to close this out, man, by asking you a question, and it would be this. Anybody who's listening to this interview, what would be a word of advice trying to make it in the industry? What would be your words to them not to quit? How would you handle that situation?
If somebody was coming to me saying, I'm going to quit and I don't want to do this anymore, what's your passion? Why are you doing this? You know, I'd want to know a few things before they told, you know, I gave them the advice. I think whatever you're trying to get out of the music industry has to come from an authentic place. If you don't authentically love the music that you're playing, stop. You have to absolutely 100% love the music that you're playing. You know, it may not be all the perfect music that you've always wanted to play your whole life, you know, like being an Iron Maiden or something like that. You have to love what you're doing.
Right.
And if you don't love it, if you can't, you know, every band has politics. I don't care what band you're in. Every single one. You know, there's a pecking order. Who writes the songs? Who picks the producer? Who does this and that? You know, there's always politics. But if you don't love what you're doing, if you don't love picking up the guitar and making noise with it, if you don't love sitting behind a microphone, working a vocal melody until it's absolutely perfect, don't do it.
Right.
But if you're going to stay in, find all the things that you love about what you're doing and focus on that. There's too many negative aspects to the music industry to even think about that, really. Oh, there's no money in it. I can't sell any records. MTV sucks. That's all true. I mean, that's fine.
Basically, just follow your dreams.
Yeah, follow your dreams. Follow your heart. You know, like, and not even follow your heart necessarily. Like, follow the most authentic version of yourself. You know, dig in and be who you are. Being who you are doesn't mean being a jerk to people that disagree with you.
That's
being
right.
Who you are means, like, finding who you are and finding peace in that and loving yourself and loving the music that you do. Because if you can't do that and you just want to be a miserable person, please leave. There's enough miserable people in any business. Music doesn't need any more of that.
That's
you know,
right.
Find a way to make yourself happy.
There it is. Well, Brandon, you know, I want to say once again that I truly thank you for this opportunity that we have had together, man. You know, as I'd stated earlier, you know, Black and Blue is an amazing band. You as as an individual guitarist, you know, what you do is just, I'm so humbled for this opportunity, and I just greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Jim. I'm very honored to be here too. You know, this is one of my first real interviews I get to do, you know, to share, you know, my thoughts about things and, you know, share my artistry and what I do. And I really appreciate you calling me and asking me to do this. It feels good.
The pleasure is definitely all mine, brother. Well, there you have it. An interview with Brandon Cook of Black and Blue. This is Jim Madonna, your host of the Power Rock Podcast. Peace.